But first up today, we're going to catch up with a name that I'm sure you know very, very well. He's a man who has become famous and infamous, I guess, all in the in the same phrase, because he's achieved incredible things over the years in many ways. But this year, of course, proved to be, I guess, the biggest year of all for him. His name is Mark Ingalls, and he's today talking to us about his book called Legs on Everest, and he joins me right now. Hello to you, Mark.
Oh, hi. How's it going?
Good. Now, look, it's great to have
you. I'm not sure I'm too keen on that infamous thing. In fact, I'm definitely not keen on the famous thing, actually. One thing I've learned, you've got to keep your head down.
Well, that's right. And well, let's start with the infamous thing first of all, because, of course, it was only a matter of months ago that you know, you came into a lot of criticism on talkback radio and around the country because you'd been climbing Mount Everest and you hadn't stopped to help a climber that was on his way sort of out of this world, literally, and you know, a lot of people criticised you for that, and yet, you know, a lot of people also said, well, what could you have done? And I thought, let's start today, get that out of the way, so we've got it over and done with, and then we'll talk about your very good book. So,
well,
you know,
it's very interesting. Somebody asked me just today, actually, it's do you think, you know, have you got over that? Do you think people have got over it? And I said, well, actually, you're speaking about it, so I guess not, you know. And that really was one of the real focuses for writing the book Legs on Everest. It was to tell the story of what Everest is really like. It's you know, how incredibly tough it is, and you do it. You write the book, and then all of a sudden, I see I got panned in the papers in the weekend, or by a particular paper, for not spending enough time talking about the guy that died. And I found that really tough, actually, because I thought I'd sort of explained it quite honestly and clearly, and so I'm not quite sure, you know, what I need to do.
Well, you know, the more I reflected on what had happened on the mountain, and here we have you. You're a double amputee. You weren't the only other person on the mountain that day, and there have been many people over the years who have died on Everest. And from what you were telling me when I spoke to you recently, this man was a man who had decided to do it all on his own. Is that right?
Yeah, but it wasn't even that. You know, the situation that he was in, he was in the very last stages of his life. The thing that no one seems to mention was he did get every bit of help he could that day, and that was the big thing. And he still died. You know, it's a very, very tough place. And that's the sort of picture that I try and paint with the words in the book. It is a really tough place, but the whole concept of people not having any humanity up there is just so completely wrong. You know, it's, if anything, there's more humanity, but there's also one thing that needs to happen, and that is you yourself need to survive. It's not about you need to climb Everest or anything else like that, but you actually need to come home, and that's the really big thing.
Because it does take lives, doesn't it, Mount Everest, for various reasons.
I mean, David Sharp, who you know, is the person we're talking about at the moment, we didn't know who he was at the time, but he was only one of, 12 people that died this year on Everest, you know? Crikey, it's... we saved probably more people than that, our expedition with our doctor and our Sherpas and the help that we gave on the mountain. It is a phenomenally tough place to be, and especially, you know, if you don't have all the I's dotted and all the T's crossed.
Mm. You know, you've got to wonder whether anyone else who climbed the mountain on the same day as you, Mark, have come home to the kind of reception you had to come home to, and the and the in-depth questioning.
Well, maybe it's interesting. Max from the Lebanon, who was on our expedition, he's a fantastic, a good friend, fantastic climber. He's got a stamp. They now have a stamp for him. The government have minted his own stamp for Everest. New Zealand's been quite unique, actually. In fact, the UK, where David Sharp is from, it was a very different slant on the attention there. But hey, that's, you know, that's life. You get on with it.
Yeah. Is it perhaps because of people like Sir Edmund Hillary, in terms of, because we have had someone who's climbed Everest, we've set this high standard of what we expect people to do should they be a Kiwi when they climb up the mountain? I mean, is it something to do with that?
No, I'm not sure about that, actually. It's, you know, I guess it certainly doesn't help the particular situation that I seem to find myself in. But it's like, as a good friend of mine said, you know, who was on the mountain with me on the day, he said, if it had been my wife or even all my kids there, I couldn't have done different. Mm-hmm. And so for me, sort of, I guess, you know, I've got over it. You know, I've written the book, tried to explain it, and golly, we just have to move on in life.
Exactly. It's time for everybody to move on. And that's what I'm going to do right now.
Oh, good on you.
Got that out the way. We've got the infamous side out the way. But listen, just tell us how dangerous it is. I mean, most of us would never even think of attempting it. To me, I would imagine the cold and also that the lack of oxygen as you get higher, those would be two big factors for me. Plus the fact I've got gammy knees, even trying to get up or get down would be a hardship. What were the hardest things for you in climbing Mount Everest?
Oh, the hardest thing is mental, actually. The hardest thing is focus. The higher I go in the Himalayas, the less disadvantage I have. You know, it's just incredibly tough for everyone. So as long as you can think in the right way, then that's a huge advantage. And that's the thing that typifies Kiwi mountaineers, you know. Mm-hmm. There were five other Kiwis on the mountain that day. And we sort of really typify that attitude. Other than that, yeah, it is just very, very tough, but that's why you do it. You know, that's why the whole essence of Everest, the whole essence of being able to do it, come home, and then have the power in your life to make a difference in the world, really. That's the critical thing.
Yeah. Well, of course, you were the first one up the top that day, too. Is that right?
No, I was actually leading our expedition all the way up to within about 50 metres of the summit.
Right.
Max was up in front by about 100 metres, and all the rest of our expedition were sort of trailed out behind me. And Dorje and I stepped aside and let the others go on up. You know, I was getting pretty tired, 50 metres from the summit, and I would have hated to have held anyone up, so I let them go on past. And we all stepped up together. It's not a race. Golly, it's just about touching the top and then getting home again.
Is there, like, on top of Mount Everest, is there, like, a little plaque or some object that tells you that is actually the top bit, or is it just the point?
Oh, it's pretty easy now when you're on the top, actually, Ellis.
Is it?
You can't go any higher, you know. and that's the only reason you know you're on the top, you know. It's just so hard. You've got your head down, you're trying to suck the air in, you take a couple of steps, you suck, and then all of a sudden, you can't take any more steps. There's just nothing in front of you, and that is the summit of the world. You know, that's how you know you're on the top.
Is there much room up there, Mark, for like a couple of people to stand, or is it quite a small amount of space?
Oh, there's a sort of a semi-level bit about the size of a single bed, and then it drops hugely steeply away on all sides. And at where your pillow is on the bed, really, I guess, there's a wee point with. You can still see a wee sort of aluminium pole that's been hammered in there. And when we were there, there was still just a couple of shreds of some prayer flags that had been left there, or some sort of flags have been left there. But, hey, the mountain cleans itself. You don't tend to leave anything up there, because it just will just get blown away.
Blown away, yeah. I imagine that the view that you got when you stood up there would be something you'd never forget. Did you have a clear day or...?
Oh, partly cloudy, and yeah, it's a view that you sort of you have sort of semi-set in the mind. The thing you really remember is the curvature of the earth.
Ah, really?
You see the curve of the earth, and that's, I guess, for other than that, unless you want to go to space, it's a bit hard to see that, and that's pretty neat, actually. You know, you don't have a double pane of windows between you and that, like you do in a jetliner. It's you're experiencing, you know, the minus 38, minus 50 degrees. You're experiencing the curvature of the earth. Other than that, it's just like the view from the tops of mountains, really. Mm. The view from the bottom is much, much better.
Yeah, that I guess that's true, isn't it, when you look up. How long does it take you to get up something like Mount Everest and then get back down? Is it longer to get up and quicker to get down?
Oh, for me it's about, it is slightly quicker to come down, but only partly actually because I slid on my backside halfway down Everest, actually. You know, I'd done a bit of damage to the stump, so I thought, well, I could do the good old Kiwi thing and sit on my backside and slide down, you know. It's a great Kiwi tradition. So yeah. It takes about 2 months on the mountain to acclimatise. You know, you're talking about 2 or 3 months out of your year or out of your life to actually on the mountain. And then the last sort of summit push is 5 days from ABC up to the summit. The last day is a long day. And then most people can actually get a long way down in a day. But as a double amputee, it takes almost as long to come down as it does to go up.
It would be very, very hard because you'd be putting a lot of extra pressure on your stumps, wouldn't you, as you're trying to come down?
Well, it's pretty similar. Yes, it is. You have multiples of your body weight go through your knee and your ankle and your foot, you know, which is when normal people walk downstairs. So just for your listeners, just imagine the next time you walk downstairs and every time you take a step down, imagine all your toes and your metacarpals and everything else, all the sinews and muscles and your Achilles tendon, your ankle bones, your calf muscle, they're all soaking up the pressure. Mm. Well, for an amputee, single or double, it's bang, straight through the stump. And that's the thing that makes it pretty difficult.
Well, you achieved a great record because you became the first double amputee to have summited an 8,000-metre peak. So that's a first, isn't it, for you?
To be the first double amputee to summit Everest was pretty neat. It wasn't the reason why I did it.
No.
I wouldn't have minded. In fact, one of the interesting things we found out was the records are actually wrong. Back in 2004, when I summited Choi Yu, the sixth highest in the world at 8,201 metres, we thought that everyone in Nepal and everyone, all the officials said, oh, you know, congratulations, you're the first, but I'm sure that I wasn't. And it's come to light that my old mentor, Norman Croucher from the UK, actually climbed Choi Yu in 1995, and he's a double amputee climber as well. He tried Everest along with one other double amputee, but no double amputee has ever made Everest. Well, until now, anyway.
Yeah, which is fantastic. Look, we've got to talk about the photo on the cover of your book, Legs on Everest. Tell us about your prosthetic legs. What do you call them? I mean, are they called prosthetic legs? Or?
I just call them my legs.
Your legs? Well, they are your legs, aren't they?
They're pretty sexy legs, too.
They're very sexy. Particularly the bottom of them, because they're literally metal feet with these huge crampons all over them. So you obviously
have... The legs are pretty neat. I have a joint venture with Wayne Alexander here in Christchurch, and we create some of my climbing, just the bottom parts of the limbs, not the sockets, which are really important. It's they are the things that define the limits you can go to, and then the source on the top, the extra curly bit, the jewel is the bottom bit, and Wayne and I do those. They're made out of carbon fiber with just normal crampons like a normal climber would wear. And it's, it's quite, with those things on, it doesn't replace your legs. I'd much rather have a set of legs, you know, real flesh and blood ones. But crikey, it's, you can just build into so many advantages with them. That's the neat thing.
Now, do you carry a spare one? I mean, or do you have spare parts on you because in case something falls off, bends, twists, puts you out of alignment?
Well, I mean, as you might remember, I did actually break one. I snapped one off at the ankle coming down from the North Col on a practice climb. We carried a spare over, but we actually rebuilt the one I broke so we could understand better.
Yeah.
And I actually used that on summit day. But we also, Dorji, my Sherpa, I'm actually walking around on my normal walking legs at the moment, and they've actually been to the summit of Everest, and that's pretty neat, actually. Dorji, my Sherpa, took... the ultralight, my normal walking legs, but he took those in his pack because he didn't want me to be legless on the summit of Everest in case I broke one. And, I've been legless more than enough since then. So pretty neat thing to walk around these days on legs that have been on the summit of Everest.
Well, I watched you just recently when I caught up with you, and I watched you walking into where I was, and you know, you'd never pick it. The movement that you had was so fluid and so natural. Nobody, apart from if you're wearing shorts, would know that you had artificial limbs.
Well, we're very lucky in New Zealand. We're very privileged in New Zealand to have fantastic limb fitters at the artificial limb boards.
And, yes.
And that's why I walk so well, because I try hard. That's number one. And they do a fantastic job. And that's why we've created the Charitable Trust Limbs for All, Anne and I, to take some of the incredibly generous donations that people have given us and take a bit of that advantage to the 400 million other disabled out there in the world.
Yeah, that's because this is going to be one of your focuses now that you're back down on the ground. You've written the book, is to promote this new charity, Limbs for All. Tell us about a bit more of what you're going to do. How are you going to provide limbs or help for the other disabled people in the world, like yourself, you know, who are amputees or whatever?
Well, we raised an awful lot of money for the Cambodia Trust on Everest, and we've just had, but also by the same token, I see so many other people that need help. And so we've created an umbrella charity, Limbs for All. We'll set it up as a capital trust, so hopefully we'll only, mostly we'll be just using the interest from it. There'll be no funding going towards the administration or anything of it. We're covering all those costs ourselves, so when people donate, it goes only in one place, and that's the place it's supposed to go. The people, where Anne and I are back in Kathmandu in March to take two hand bikes actually back to the spinal unit over there. We'll be still supporting the Cambodia Trust a lot. They have such a huge job to do over there, and you know there are young amputees in New Zealand that need help to source great sports limbs, and just so many other people out there that for a little bit of help, a little bit of effort from us Kiwis can sometimes be an absolutely life-changing event for Salmonella's disease.
Yes, I can imagine that. You talked about hand bikes too, and I'm trying to conjure up an image of what a hand bike is and how it would be used. Can you explain that?
Take a wheelchair and on the front of it, put the back half of a bike, okay?
Yep.
And so you, instead of pedaling a bike with your feet for a paraplegic or a quadriplegic, you know, for a spinal patient, they use their hands on what would be the pedals, and it drives the front wheel. In fact, there are some that just clip onto a wheelchair and can just drag the wheelchair around. And what it means in a tough place like Nepal, where there are so many spinal patients, to get round in a wheelchair over there is just so tough.
It would be.
But you put one of these things on the front, and golly, they can go just about anywhere. But, you know, they cost a few thousand dollars each, so... Yeah. Up to $4,000 or $5,000 each, so it's very, very, very tough for people over there. So we're looking at designing one that suits their environment, that's tough, got mountain bike tires on it, things like that. And for them over there, it's just so much freedom.
Great stuff. Well, listen, is there a website that we can find out more information about what you're doing in this kind of area?
Well, always keep an eye on legsoneverest.co.nz, .com.
Yeah.
But Limbs for All, so it's Limbs, the letter four, all. That will be up and going by about the middle of next week.
Okay.
And people will be able to donate online if they so wished, but most importantly, they'll be able to follow some of our the work that we do in Tibet and Nepal and Cambodia and in so many other places.
Wonderful. Anderson, since you've been back home from Everest, of course, you're a little bit shorter, aren't you, than when you went up? Because you lost a little bit on your fingers and
I had 3 centimetres trimmed off both stumps just because of the mechanical damage I did on the way back down. You know, my own silly fault, really. But my height is determined by how long I want the wee pylons that are underneath the socket. So I'm a bit of a shorty at the moment, actually. It makes it a bit easier to walk and... you know, give me another week or two, I'll be back up to my old height. And, you know, crikey, after Christmas with a bit of extra weight on, I might have to go up to a 6 foot or so.
You could do indeed. Hey, Mark, it's been great to catch up with you again. And to you and Anne and the whole family, I hope you have a wonderful break over the festive season. I hope your book sells well and lots of people buy it. And I hope a lot of people go online to legsoneverest.com or Limbs for All, and that's the number 4, limbsforall.com. And donate generously and keep up with the kind of work that you're doing out there. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, Alison. Thanks for the support of all your listeners. You know, it's, we can't make a difference in the world without the help of everyone else.
Well, all the very best to you, Mark. And I hope, as I say, I hope the book goes well. And we look forward to catching up again some other time and finding out about your next adventure.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Thanks for your time. Bye-bye. And that's Mark Ingalls. The book is called Legs on Everest, the full story of his most remarkable adventure yet, because of course there's got to be another one at some stage, and that's published by Random House, and that's available in all good bookstores right now. Look out for the cover with Mark on the front, with his artificial limbs with the big crampons on, climbing some part of a mountain, probably some part near the top of Everest. It's a fantastic shot and a very interesting book if you want to hear about great adventures.